In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Have any of you heard the name Sebastian Junger? Raise your name. Anybody heard that name? Sebastian Junger? Wow, one. Awesome. He's really penetrated the culture around here. He's an author. He's a journalist. He likes to go into really dangerous locations in which to write his books. And he wrote a rather controversial book earlier this year entitled Tribe. Ringing any bells yet? Awesome. This is his observation. He has spent a lot of time with people in war-torn places. He has embedded himself with troops. He has gone into places where there is either political conflict or medical issues, and he's just lived among people that have been traumatized for a lot of reasons. And he's made an important observation, having hung out with people that have been in those locations, but also in talking to people from previous eras that have also been in war and in conflict. And this is his observation, that today, in today's conflicts, in today's war-torn experiences, in today's crises and traumas, the mortality rate is actually much lower, and the casualty rate is much lower than in any era in recorded history when it comes to conflicts or crises. It's just a different way. War is still hell. But war is a different kind of hell now in the way in which war is prosecuted. And therefore, people don't get hurt as often and people don't die as easily as they did in other eras. And yet there's this paradox that despite that lower mortality rate, despite that lower casualty rate, that those who come home today from wars and traumas and crises actually report a higher incidence of chronic disorientation and destabilization in their very soul. And so you will hear the word, you will hear the acronym, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, all over the place. And the incidence of PTSD among those who have been in wars and in crises is just astronomically higher than any other era, despite the fact that there's a lower casualty rate and mortality rate. And so Sebastian Junger makes this rather controversial deduction on his part. Yes, war is awful, and yes, crises are awful, but they're not entirely awful. Because something happens in those locations where the communities that come together in those experiences are really profound, and there are a certain series of boundaries that get lost, and there's a sort of social cohesion that occurs in moments like that, that when they come home, they don't have that like they did there. And so the peoples unto whom they return, that there's something profoundly lacking as compared to what they had in those places that were full of crisis and trauma and war and blood and harm. And so he says on the front of your bulletin, recovery from war, from any trauma, is heavily influenced by the society one belongs to. And there are societies that make that process relatively easy. Modern society does not seem to be one of them. Humans don't mind hardship. In fact, they thrive on it. What they mind is not feeling necessary. And so he writes this book called Tribe. And the overarching sub-theme of that book is that those to whom you are related and how you are related to them is as crucial as any aspect of your humanity. No matter what you do, no matter what you're accomplished, no matter what you've been through, who you're related to matters. And if you don't believe that, listen to those that have been through trauma. Many of us among us this morning are guests, and we have during the season of Advent been considering the doctrine that tries to explain the doctrine of the incarnation. Why did God unite himself to flesh? Because he came to unite us to God through faith in the one who united himself to flesh. The incarnation is for the purpose of our union with Christ. And so we have looked each week at some aspect of the doctrine of union, not just trying to unpack the theme, but also to unwrap the gifts that are associated with it. Christ is our greatest gift by virtue of our union with Him. But then we have, in the last few weeks, talked about the gift of a new identity, the gift of a new freedom. And this morning, we want to look at one other gift of our union with Christ, and that is the gift of a treasured tribe. We've referred to it earlier in this service as a family. We're going to refer to it for the remainder of this day as a tribe. And what we want to ask are really just two questions. Why is this tribe, who you are a part of, really a treasure? And then how do you treat it as a treasure that it is? Why is this tribe a treasure? And how do you treat it as a treasure? We're going to listen to Peter tell us the answer to those two questions. Would you stand? We're going to read from 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 1. So put away all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn infants. Long for the pure spiritual milk, that by it you may grow up into salvation, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is good. As you come to Him, a living stone, rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in Scripture, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone chosen and precious, and whoever believes in Him will not be put to shame. So the honor is for you who believe. But for those who don't believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumble because they disobey the word, as they were destined to do. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you're God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. All right, why is this tribe a treasure? But you know what? That's a little bit ahead of ourselves. First things first, why call the church a tribe at all? Peter used just about every other word he could use to refer to the church but tribe. He didn't use the word tribe. He might have. He didn't. And secondly, given how we think of tribes today, we tend to associate it with the word tribalism, which is all about thinking of yourself as most important and thinking of everybody else as like the enemy. And like, so we've just been through an election season, and we will still be in that season in which tribalism reigns. Like, we're the good ones and you guys are the enemies, and never the twain shall meet. So we probably ought to sit down here for a second and say, why might we call the church a tribe? Why might we call us in this room, CTK, and the local church a tribe? Tribe works here, I think, for a couple reasons. Tribe in the sense that we are more than just a collection of people who share in a certain assent to particular doctrines. We are more than just a people that gather once a week and do similar things and inhabit similar practices. We are a people who matters to all, where each of us matters to all of us, and all of us matter to each of us. That's a tribe. It's what a tribe is. It's how we might think of a tribe. But let's just make sure that the text is saying that. In verses 4 and 5, the church, Peter is saying, are those who are more than just a collection. They're more than just an assemblage of individuals. And he says to them in verses 4 and 5 of him, as you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but chosen and precious in God's sight, you too are living stones. All right, let's stop there for just a minute. When Peter says, as you come to him, what he means there is he's talking about people who are enamored with Christ, who've been converted to him, who listen and follow. Because to believe him is to belong to him. It's to be united with him. That's been our argument for the entirety of this series. That's what it means to be united to Jesus. And therefore, in that regard, we are more than just followers of an ethical way. We are people who are in him, and he who is in us. But when Peter speaks of Jesus as a living stone, that is a metaphor for something more than just an ethical ideal. To call Jesus a living stone is to say that he is real, he is alive, he's existing, he's an enduring presence, he's the one who's at work on our behalf, at a remove, but not. But for Peter to refer to Jesus as a living stone is to mean also this. Those who are in him are like him. And that's why Peter says what is true of Jesus is also true of those who are in him. They too are living stones. And as he is a living stone and we are living stones, what do? They come together to form, in Peter's words, a spiritual house. Stone upon stone, stone together, they form a spiritual house. And as soon as you start talking language of spiritual house, you have just stepped into a massive theme of the Old Testament. David says to the Lord in 2 Samuel 7, I will build you a house for your name. I will build you a temple where people will come and worship you. And God says to David, thanks, but it's not going to be you. Your heir will. Solomon will, and Solomon does, and you can read all about the ornate, elaborate construction of the temple, a house for his name in the book of 1 Kings and elsewhere, and in 1 Kings 8, when Solomon dedicates the temple, he says near the end of that dedicatory prayer, will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, highest heaven cannot contain him, how much less this house. People are going to come and worship him at that temple. People are going to come and extol his name in that house. But that house will not constrain him. It will not be bound by the four walls of that ornate edifice. And so when Peter speaks of a spiritual house, he's talking about a far more expansive space in which God will be pleased to act and work. Jesus and those who are in him will all possess physical bodies, but they will form a spiritual house in and through which God, who is spirit, will choose to act and delight to act in and through them. And that's why Peter calls it a house, a space. You go to the Dallas Arboretum. That's a place that's designed, it's cordoned off, it's a special area, and everything that is beautiful is particularly constructed and designed to celebrate that which is true about horticulture, that which is beautiful about horticulture. It's, if you will, a sacred space set apart to show forth the glories of flowers and plants and all those things. That's what the church is. That's what a spiritual house is. It's a place set apart in which to show forth that which is beautiful in the one who designs that space. But there's a reason that God and Peter speaks of the people of God as a spiritual house. Because that metaphor implies many things. A house is that which has order and integrity. It speaks of incorporation. It speaks of interdependence. Now, all of us live in some form of apartment or house, and they are notorious for sometimes reflecting anything but unity. anything but incorporation, anything but integrity. And that's why we try to do everything we can to keep it whole together. But a house in itself represents a kind of unity in that each part is integral to another. What happens to the door affects the remainder of the house. What happens to the windows affects the remainder of the house. And so when Jesus and Peter speak about stones, of Jesus as a living stone, as we as living stones, stones matter to other stones. And when a few stones get loose, the whole house is affected. And brothers and sisters, a real tribe is like that. The community matters to the individual. The individual matters to the community. So yes, it's fitting that we would call ourselves a tribe because Peter speaks of us as a house in which every part matters to each other's part. But back to our original question then. So we're a tribe. But why are we a treasured tribe? Why are we a tribe to be treasured? Let me give you three quick reasons why this tribe is a treasured tribe. It's treasured because of a proud heritage, because of a privileged commission, and because of a protective essence. A proud heritage, a privileged commission, a protective essence. Let's go with that. I think you all saw, if you were listening carefully, that at the center of this passage is the identity of the head of the tribe. It's talking about Jesus. And earlier we spoke of Jesus as that living stone because Peter does. And we said Peter makes that comparison, uses that metaphor to make a comparison between who he is and who we are. But there's another reason why Peter employs that metaphor to refer to Jesus. Not only is he like those who are part of the same spiritual house, but he is a living stone because he is unlike anyone else. Because as a living stone, he is a stone with a story. And as you saw in the indentation of your text, and as you heard Peter say as it stands in Scripture, he recites three Old Testament passages, two from Isaiah, one from the Psalms. And all of them have that had a, when they were originally uttered, had this enigmatic idea that while Israel was crumbling at its foundations, God would come as a stone. He would lay a stone in Zion. He would lay a new foundation upon which Israel would rest and upon which it would take its cues. And by so doing, it would come to discover its old glory and begin to rediscover its old mandate. And that stone, whatever it was, the rabbis would reflect on that and thought, what did Isaiah mean by that? And what did the psalmist who wrote that, what did he mean by that? And eventually they came to mean that that probably means he's talking about God's anointed one, God's Messiah, whoever that might be, whether he's come already or whether he's soon to come. And then later the enigma starts to get some clarity. Because in the wake of Jesus' coming and going, people look back at what Isaiah said, and people look back at what the psalmist said, and they say to themselves, I found him. There he is. This one who said to Peter, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. This one who looked at Peter when Jesus was being rejected by those who knew the most about Isaiah, who knew the most about the Psalms. They're the ones who rejected him. People began to reflect upon the grandeur of Jesus, the character of Jesus, the authority of Jesus, the life of Jesus, the grace of Jesus. And they began to think themselves, I think we found him. Because even Jesus himself quotes Psalm 118 when he says, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. He's the stone. He's the stone with a story. And he's the head, as the stone, of this tribe. And therefore, anybody who's part of this tribe is a proud heir. Because they walk in his name, They follow in his footsteps. And the question therefore asks ourselves is, why does that make this tribe a treasured tribe? Both Jesus himself and John the Baptist use another metaphor to refer to himself, and that metaphor is one of a bridegroom. John the Baptist says, when the bridegroom comes for the bride, the friend of the bridegroom rejoices to hear his voice. When Paul speaks of the church, he compares it to that which exists between a husband and a wife. And therefore, what he is saying is the contour of the commitment for those in the church, in the tribe of Jesus, is comparable to the commitment found in marriage. And anybody who's been married knows that the contours of the commitment in marriage is immeasurably high, nigh on impossible. And therefore, the expectation in marriage is high, and the expectation in the tribe, in the church, is also high. Brothers and sisters, all of you are part of different kind of communities. And some of those communities expect very little from you. You get newsletters from them. Or they say, send us dues, and that's it. But they don't ask anything more from you. They may deliver a lot to you. They may give you a service. They may do stuff for you, and you dig that. But if the expectation is low, here's the deal. You don't really lose a lot of sleep about who's in charge of the organization, their commitment to you, whether they are fiercely committed to you or not. They could be totally committed to themselves, and it really wouldn't matter because that community doesn't really ask much of you. But in the communities that do expect a lot from you, and who sometimes make promises to you that have to be deferred until later, you know what really matters? Is the commitment of the one who's the head of the organization. If you can't trust that they're really committed to you, then you will not be sustained in your commitment to that entity. When it comes to Jesus, you never have to ask that question. Because though he asks much in your devotion to the tribe that he's come to found in his name, you will never be asked as much. You will never have to be devoted as much to this tribe as he has already shown himself committed and devoted to you. And that's why this is a treasured tribe. Because it has a proud heritage. Because he is its heritage. That's the first reason why it's a treasured tribe. Here's the second. It's because you've got a privileged commission by virtue of being part of this tribe. Next to talking about the identity of Jesus, the one thing it spends the most time on talking about is the identity of this church, the identity of this tribe. And Peter rattles off a whole list of names and monikers to express the identity of you who are the church. He speaks of us as a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. And if you know anything about the Old Testament, then you know that every single one of those phrases has an Old Testament lineage. Because every single one of those phrases is a phrase applied to Israel itself. And what Peter is saying is that those phrases now apply to Jew and Gentile alike who find Jesus to be their head. And therefore, what all of those phrases and names signify in summary is this idea that you and I are a tribe set apart from all other nations in order to be a tribe that exists for all other nations. A tribe set apart from all other nations in order to be a tribe that exists for all other nations. You are chosen. But chosen in order to be a blessing beyond your borders. You are a priesthood which is out to serve God. But you're a priesthood that's out to mediate the presence of God between him and all other peoples. You are a people for his own possession. But so that others who are outside the confines of this people might come to belong to God and thereby become belonging to this tribe. That's who you are. That's your mandate, and that's your privilege. And like every other tribe that you've heard of, it finds its vitality, which is grounded in becoming solid and for one another. But unlike most other tribes, this tribe finds its vitality in a commitment to everybody else who's not part of this tribe. Brothers and sisters, you know what is one soon-to-be application of this moment? It's what you heard during the announcements this morning. In 3 weeks, Caitlin and Cameron Mullins, the founders of that organization For the Nations, who work to help refugees who have come from places like Aleppo to settle here in this country, to be able to sleep at night, and to navigate the tough places to be even in this country. They're going to come and speak to us during second hour. Because after several weeks and months of discussing and imagining and praying, we would like to form a partnership with them. Because you may not know this, but within a mile of here are Syrian refugees that live in apartment complexes that are wondering, what will it be like to live here? And so as part of our outward-facing identity as a tribe that's set apart from other nations in order to exist for other nations, we're going to figure out what it would mean for us to take baby steps to exist for this other nation that is literally at our back door. Because that's part of our privileged commission. Why is that privileged commission our treasure or reason to treasure this tribe? Saw an animated film with some of my kids last week that I really heartily recommend to you. It's called The Secret of the Kells. It's a Belgian film. It's about a medieval Celtic community. It's run by an abbot. And there is rumors of barbarians that are coming and beginning to encroach upon this community. And so what is this community spending most of their time doing? Building these high, strong walls to keep them out. And the abbot's in charge. And the abbot cares for his little nephew whose parents have died. But in that community, there is also this thing called the scriptorium. It's like a library, and it's run by a monk who's out not only to preserve the books that are, but to write more books, to preserve knowledge, to share knowledge. And he commissions this little nephew to learn to help write the books, for he has written a book called The Book of Iona, which the movie kind of obscures, but it's actually a copy of the New Testament written and printed in this wonderfully ornate and elaborate color in gold thread and linen. The abbot finds that all a waste of time. And yet, at the heart of the picture is this little nephew and certain spirits that help him discover the beauty of creating this book and preserving its knowledge. And yet the marauders come, and they breach the walls, and they set fire to the community, and the community is displaced, and the abbot comes to a little bit of learning. And later, years later, upon reflection, he comes back in touch with his young nephew, who is now an older man and an adult. And he says to him what he's learned as a consequence of that awful experience of the community being overrun by marauders and of him trying to squelch the production of this book. He says to his nephew Brendan, "The book was never meant to be hidden away behind walls, locked away from the world which inspired its creation. Rather, it must be taken to the people so that they may have hope." The theme of the movie is the commission to which you and I are privileged to be given. The abbot learns what you and I all must learn, and that is the need is greater to give out what is cherished than for us to keep it to ourselves. That there is joy that is greater in giving out what we cherish rather than in keeping it to ourselves. And so why this tribe is to be treasured is because it reflects a feature that is fundamental to our humanity, and that is that we serve what we love, but we also share what we love. It's why we love it. It's why we love to share it. This tribe is treasured because it invites us to live as you and I love, because we make known and available that which we have come to cherish. And that's our nature. That's our commission. That's why this tribe is to be treasured. One more reason why it's to be treasured, and it has a lot to do with this notion of our outward-facing mandate, our outward-facing privilege. Richard Bauckham wrote an essay several years ago in which he notes an irony and tragedy when it comes to the Christian faith. Our faith centers on the belief of the head of the tribe dying for those who were to him enemies, or rather they were enemies to him. He died for those who were objects of wrath, and he died in love. And yet, brothers and sisters, there are too many examples in church history of the church learning to not love its neighbors but oppress them. There are too many books that are too well researched that elucidate too many seasons in which the community whose name is ostensibly love, acting in ways that were diametrically opposed to the love on which it was founded. And on that, both Richard Bauckham and other historians find great tragedy. And those who look on, who are not Christians, wonder if the church is not somehow fatally flawed, given how many instances the church has sought not to love or show mercy, but to oppress. But brothers and sisters, did you hear what Peter said in verse 9 and 10? Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not been shown mercy, but now you have been shown mercy. That's our story. That's the DNA of this tribe. Once you were not privileged to be able to be part of a community that might say that they belong to God, but now you can. Once you were only in need of mercy and could not get it from elsewhere, but now it's been come your way. The remembrance of your former self in view of your present self is what is meant to imbue you with a humble self. And it's in that humility that there is absolutely no room for enacting coercion or oppression at any time, in any place, for any reason. This tribe is to be treasured because it has a protective essence. It has built into its own identity, into its essence, the very humility that protects it from becoming a terror to itself or to the world it finds itself in. It's in the bylaws, for God's sake, brothers and sisters. The reason church history is so pockmarked with oppressive seasons is not because the church was fulfilling its identity, but because it's forgotten it. And when we remember it and we hold to it, we discover that this tribe is in fact a treasure. What does that all have to do with us at the local level? Here's what it has to do with it. As a member of this tribe, to proclaim the excellencies of God, as Peter instructs us to do, means that you will demonstrate and speak of God's goodness to others who don't hold to that, both in word and in deed. And sometimes, they will not find it persuasive. And in that moment, what do? You shake hands, you tip your hat, and you say, "I was glad to make your acquaintance." You sure don't lash out. And you surely don't deride, because it's not you, it's beneath you. And when we as a church, we as a local church, we as a church in this country, where if we cannot convince enough people that the way we embody is in fact right, and therefore another way takes hold, and we can do nothing about it, what do? We take heart, we regroup, but we don't lash out. And we don't find underhanded ways in which to see our way prevail. Because to fail to show mercy is to have forgotten oneself and one's story. And that's the last reason why this tribe is to be treasured. So how do we treasure it? If it is a treasure, how do you treasure it? Most of the application of this passage is what comes at the very beginning, in verse 1. And what Peter says there in verses 1 and 2 is to suggest that what most threatens this tribe is not what will decimate it from without, but what will poison it from within. And so he says in verse 1, having put away all malice and all deceit and all hypocrisy and envy and slander. You know what all those vices have in common? They're all vices that threaten community. And while they are certainly things to be concerned about in any relationship that you have, Peter is focusing his attention on our relationship to one another as members of this tribe of whom Jesus is the head. And when he says, having put away those vices, he's not talking about mild reflection upon those things is bad, certain attitudes of circumspectness about that thing. He's talking about a deliberate, uncompromising repudiation of any of those things from ever taking root in our community. The word there, put away, is originally in the Greek the idea of taking off a garment. You have kids, and they get nasty outside, and they hit the threshold. You know what we say when they hit the front door? Don't you dare walk in this house with that stuff on your body. Don't you dare. I don't care if you freeze your fanny out on the front porch. Take it off. Peter is saying, don't you dare come into this community with that stuff in your heart. Don't you dare walk into this place with that stuff. Are you speaking or thinking of ill of one another? Put it off. Take it off. Are you saying one thing but doing something else? Take it off. Are you inwardly despising somebody else for what they have and you don't? Leave that outside. Those insidious inward attitudes that become actions are poison. And they threaten and compromise the tribe's capacity to fulfill that privileged commission. But you and I know, taking off garments at the front door versus acting ruthlessly towards those vices are not the same thing. It's not just about repressing those vices. There's something more to it. Brothers and sisters, let's just put it this way. If it took the mercy of God to form this tribe, then you and I should probably expect to see those kind of vices among us, right? You shouldn't be shocked by that. New members, I'm sorry if you feel like this is a bait and switch, but we're a people that struggles with malice and deceit and envy and hypocrisy. I'm sorry. We just are. Sorry. But thank God that we might. Because at least in a community that suffers from malice and envy and hypocrisy, love one another and get to know one another as involved with one another. We're not just pleasantly anonymous to one another. But how do you put off those vices? I had an impromptu conversation with Kevin via text yesterday on the Greek syntax of verses 1 and 2. And though your ESV translation divides verses 1 and 2 into two sentences, a good Greek syntactical case can be made that they are actually one sentence. Such that when Peter says, having put away, and then he lists those vices, then in verse 2, as newborn children, long for the pure spiritual milk that by it you may grow up into salvation. That having put away all those vices is in some sense related to this idea of longing for the pure spiritual milk. They go together. And right now, you just heard, long for the pure spiritual milk. And most of you are thinking, he's going to say we should read our Bibles more. And I might say, why not? But I will also say, because I think Peter would also say, it's more than that. In fact, it's deeper than that. It's not just about reading fervently or regularly, as beneficial as that might be. That word there for spiritual milk, the word there is the word logikon, from which you and I get the word logic. It's about reason. It's about mindful, not mindfulness, sort of a loaded term these days. It's this idea of really contemplating what is this reality into which we've been brought by virtue of our union with Jesus. And when Peter invokes that word and then couples it with Psalm 33, taste and see that the Lord is good, this is what he's talking about. Brothers and sisters, to long for the pure spiritual milk is for you to do whatever it takes whatever it takes for you to savor God more than anything else that might command your attention. I read an essay by Alan Jacobs yesterday, who has spent decades trying to be a source of reconciliation between warring factions. And he has learned something in those 20 years of trying to bring two parties together. He says, people's enmities tend to be their treasures. People's enmities tend to be their treasures. We get something out of being sideways with one another. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so persistently and consistently sideways with one another. There's a certain delight to it, even though it's a corrosive delight. When Peter says, long for the pure spiritual milk, he's asking you to seek God in every way that you know how and in ways that you don't even know how yet, in order that you might treasure him more than in whatever reasons you might have to be at enmity with one another. And to seek him by seeking the one who came to bring reconciliation between us and him. To seek him in the gospel. Brothers and sisters, that word there, taste and see that the Lord is good, it's the word Christos. And we all know what the name of Jesus is, Christos. It's a one-letter difference. To seek the good is to seek him. And that means you and I, from time to time, have to go deep into what is animating our enmity. And then we have to get with one another of those who we're in conflict with. When you were in school, you learned a lot in class. But you know where else you learned a lot about life? On the playground. You learned about inclusion and exclusion. You learned about how to get along. You learned about how to make up. You learned about what it took in order to get back in the kickball game. You learned all that on the playground. Brothers and sisters, you know who this is? This is God's playground he's given to you. This is God's family he's given unto you. This is God's tribe he's given unto you. And it is this tribe where you and I learn how to become more like him who is the head of this tribe. To grow up into our salvation, apparently, means learning to savor God so much that we learn how to set aside our malice, envy, hypocrisy, slander, and evil. Brothers and sisters, that's how we treasure this tribe. Because in our effort to be faithful as a tribe, we're going to meet crises. In our efforts just to survive in this world, we're going to meet crises. And in our effort to be the tribe, as we're meant to be a tribe, we're going to encounter crises. But in treasuring this tribe as we ought, the traumas we will feel will be different. And then as we treasure it, we will discover that it is his gift to us, as surely as Jesus is our greatest gift to us. Amen.